Hello, Mark here. Before we begin today's episode, I would just like to quickly take the time to ask all of those who are enjoying the series a favour. If the platform you use to listen to Castings for Ancient Greece has a rating or review system, I would be extremely grateful if you would consider leaving the series a quick review. These ratings and reviews go a long way into helping others discover the show, in turn helping it grow. So if you enjoy the series and can spare a few minutes, I would love to read what you have to say about your experiences with the show. Thanks everyone for your support. And let's get to today's episode. In the sixth year of the truce, war broke out between the Samians and Milesians about Perini. Worsted in the war, the Milesians came to Athens with loud complaints against the Samians. In this, they were joined by certain private persons from Samos itself, who wished to change the constitution by revolution. Accordingly, the Athenians sailed to Samos with 40 ships and set up a democracy, Thucydides. Hello, I'm Mark Selick, and welcome back to Castings for Ancient Greece, Episode 64, The Samian War. Well, we have now seen ourselves through this first major conflict since the Greek and Persian Wars. As we have seen, the build-up to this conflict seems to have been rooted in the situation the Greek world found itself in after the Persian defeat. However, we can't discount the suspicions that had existed before the Persian invasions, but now Athens had seen its influence and wealth grow as a result. As we saw last episode, the 30 years' peace had seen both Athens and Sparta officially recognise the systems of alliances each held, though this parting of interests into two separate spheres began after Persia's defeat in 479 BC. Sparta had already had the Peloponnesian League in existence, but the Persian invasions had seen Athens and Sparta a part of a common alliance. This, however, only remained intact while a common enemy existed, and once defeated, their other interests came to the surface. For Athens, this had seen the creation of the Delian League with other Greek islands and cities in the eastern Aegean with a common interest. This would see the two city-states pursue their separate interests, though Athens' new league would see their wealth and power grow even more over the decades. These decades would also see Sparta's suspicions grow even further regarding Athens and its actions. This would end up leading to conflict breaking out within the Greek lands. However, this first Peloponnesian war would see the two sides avoid one another on the battlefield, bar for one occasion at Tanagra. Although Sparta had won this fight, both had suffered heavy losses, and Sparta was in no position to continue their campaign. This war would see both looking to influence the other side through indirect means, by focusing on allies or areas of influence rather than attacking each other directly. This would end up seeing Athens extending its newly minted empire further within Greece itself, encroaching on what had been seen previously as Spartan-controlled. However, Sparta may have also been able to capitalise on the indirect approach, seeing in the last years of the First Peloponnesian War that much of the Athenian gains had been reversed. The reverses had also led to what could have potentially seen another Athenian and Spartan clash, where Sparta saw Athens in a weakened state and invaded Attica. Though before battle could be joined, an agreement would be made, seeing Sparta return home and form the foundation of what would turn out to be the 30 years' peace. The peace would see both sides agreeing on pulling out of areas that the other had influence over, while also recognising each other's alliances, this leading to the two power blocks developing. This would see the war come to an end, and both would now be able to turn their attention to matters within their respective alliances. For this episode, we will look to the immediate aftermath, which would see Sparta and Athens looking to stabilise their politics at home, as this would be the major factor in seeing this peace undone. While we'll also see Athens' continued challenges of maintaining its empire in the eastern Aegean, with us also focusing on a sizeable conflict breaking out known as the Samian War. Although Athens had dealt with a number of revolts already within their empire, they would need to remain vigilant, as in an area as large as the one Athens oversaw, there were bound to be those members with other interests looking to gain an advantage that suited them, not the League, or rather Athens. This would not be the only concern Athens had to deal with. On the edges of the eastern territories that they held influence in was the Persian Empire. Although a peace had been signed, surely any sign of weakness or an opportunity too good to refuse would see Persian influence make its way into Athenian-controlled areas. Athens was now in a position where a stable political situation at home would greatly benefit their chances of maintaining the agreed peace with Sparta. We had seen that the policy during the First Peloponnesian War was quite aggressive with how Athens operated on the mainland. This sort of action would need to be a thing of the past if the agreement was to stand, though it now seems Athens was in a position to see that these aggressive actions towards Sparta were no longer part of the way forward. If we turn to the historian Donald Kagan's way of reasoning, it seems as though this came about due to the actions and consequences of the war. Although we are not entirely certain of who in Athens was pushing the different policies and campaigns, Kagan argues that more aggressive moves on the Peloponnese and in Boeotia were not the work of Pericles. As we had seen, Pericles had seemed to have been distant from Ephialtes' aggressive policies towards Sparta around 460 BC, even though being closely aligned when it came to domestic matters. It would seem the general Ptolemides had been the leader of those still supporting this path forward. Though, with the death of Ptolemides at Coronea and the disastrous fallout from this defeat, it appears that this following had not only lost their leader, but support for their more extreme policies had waned with the disaster of this campaign. So it had seemed that this would now allow Pericles and those backing him to shift their focus back to a more restrained approach to foreign affairs. However, disintegration of support behind the faction that Ptolemides led would not all shift automatically to Pericles. There were other matters of importance to the Athenians, and on the basis of domestic policies, the conservatives of Athens were seeing a resurgence in support. A new political figure would emerge that we are yet to meet, that would rise up and to be the head of these conservative policies. This man was Thucydides, however, not the Thucydides that we are familiar with, though it is thought that they may have been related. This Thucydides, son of Milesius, would head a movement that was looking to roll back the changes that had been made by the reforms Ephialtes had started. For this reason, it is probably safe to assume the major area of support for this faction was from the old aristocratic families and those who were made wealthy through them. As we had seen, after the Persian defeat in 479 BC, Athens had rolled back to a system that saw aristocrats with more of a hold on power. It was this situation that Thucydides and his supporters looked to drive Athens back to. Through Plutarch's Life of Pericles, we see that Thucydides was a very effective leader, an able politician. For us today, it is common for all those connected to a faction or political party to be seated together when meeting. Though in ancient times these connections individuals had to particular factions were not as hard and fast, which would see the supporters spread throughout the assembly. However, we hear it would be Thucydides who would arrange his supporters to be seated together in the assembly to increase their perceived strength and making them seem more united. The main strategy that the conservatives took to attempt to dampen Pericles' popularity was to attack the source of income that funded his welfare programs. If this could be curtailed, much of the popular support he had, since so many of his supporters would have benefited from them. This would see Thucydides attack the manner in which Pericles used the funds from the league's treasury, being careful not to criticize Athens, but rather Pericles, attempting to connect him to the practices of a tyrant. This political sparring between the two factions would appear to continue on for some years, where both leaders appear to be on par with one another. Plutarch relates an interesting anecdote when apparently King Archidamus of Sparta asked Thucydides who was the better wrestler. Thucydides responded, "When I have thrown and given him a fair fall, by persisting that he had no fall, he gets the better of me and makes the bystanders, in spite of their own eyes, believe him." Of course, in this anecdote, wrestling is a metaphor for the ongoing political sparring, where when Thucydides thought he had Pericles beat, he would recover. Eventually, though, we would be told that the years of back and forward in the assembly would come to a head in a great debate focused on Pericles' supposed misuse of league funds. Plutarch would record part of what Pericles is supposed to have provided as a rebuttal to Thucydides' charges. For his part, Pericles would instruct the people that it owed no account of their monies to their allies, provided it carried on the war for them and kept off the barbarians. "Not a horse do they furnish," said he, "not a ship, not a hoplite, but money simply, and this belongs not to those who give it, but those who take it, if only they furnish that for which they take in pay. And it is but meet that the city, when once she is sufficiently equipped with all that is necessary for prosecuting the war, should apply her abundance to such works as, by their completion, will bring her everlasting glory, and while in process of completion will bring that abundance into actual service. In that all sorts of activity and diversified demands arise, which rouse every art and stir every hand, and bring, as it were, the whole city under pay, so that she not only adorns but supports herself as well from her own resources." It would appear that Pericles was able to maintain a majority within Athenian politics, though the dangers of Thucydides and his faction still remained. He had proven to be a crafty politician and could recover and put further charges forward. However, there was still another avenue open to Pericles to try and take advantage of, while he still had the majority support in the assembly. We have seen this at work previously in the series, when political opponents became too much of a threat, the tool of ostracism. It had originally been devised as a means of protecting democracy from would-be tyrants, though it had been found useful in eliminating political opposition and deciding a path forward for Athens around policies. In 443, a proposal was put forward to hold an ostracism, which was voted to go ahead. I have alluded to the fact that Pericles seems to be the one to initiate proceedings, though it is worth pointing out that there are historians who also point to Thucydides as putting the proposal forward. Though ostracisms were risky business, one would want to ensure that they held the majority of support within Athenian politics, something Thucydides did not have at this stage. If anyone was going to have a good chance of getting their way in the vote, it would be Pericles. The result of the vote would go in Pericles' favour, and in 442, Thucydides would find himself having to depart Attica for 10 years. This saw the unity around the conservative faction disintegrate, and saw a form of stability develop with Athenian domestic politics for the time being. In the wake of the 30 Years' Peace, it was not only domestic matters that were taking place, but Athens was also involved in developments further afield. We see in this period just after the signing of the peace with Sparta, that Athens would establish interests west in southern Italy. It is possible we had seen Athens attempting to move down this path in the preceding decades, with alliances made with Egesta in western Sicily and possibly with Rhegium in southern Italy. While during the First Peloponnesian War, we had seen Athenian control develop in the Corinthian Gulf, which would have opened up better access west to Athens. However, it is unclear if these involvements west were part of a concerted effort to establish Athenian influence in southern Italy, with connections to what would now take place. Athens would be approached by the Sabarites of southern Italy to assist them in establishing a colony. Sabrice had been founded in 420 BC in southern Italy by Greeks from the mainland. However, by the late 6th century, their neighbour, Croton, subjected the city. The descendants of the late 6th century population would attempt to re-establish their city, though Croton would see the attempt thwarted. This is when they would send help to the Greek mainland, to both Sparta and Athens, now that they were in a state of peace. Sparta would decline to become involved, while Athens would assist in establishing the colony, along with some other Greek cities. However, not long after the colony was established, the Sabarites would seek to give themselves higher representation within the city. The quarrels that would develop around this would end in revolution. The result of this would see Greek settlers expelling the Sabarites, moving the city and renaming it Thurii. It then appears a similar system of democracy was established, and a system of 10 tribes, named after the locations the Greek settlers originated from. It must be noted that this is a very brief account of what took place, as our main source on this aspect, Diodorus, and other scattered accounts, make for a very confusing picture, and give rise to debates over Athenian motivations. Though for our purposes, Thurii appears to be the point where Athenian influence to some degree enters into southern Italy in a more meaningful way than before. We even find the colony would act on a long-standing claim Athens had on the regions north of Thurii, where war would break out between them and the old Spartan colony of Taros. For now, we will leave Thurii and Athens' interests here, though we will see that their involvement would potentially see some level of unease with Corinth. Now though, let's head to developments taking place in the east. Also requiring Athenian attention was continued rebellions unfolding in the east. The measures we saw Athens put in place after regaining control over the Euboean cities had gone some way into tightening their grip over their empire. However, if opportunity presented itself, it appears there were those cities and islands willing to take the gamble, attempting to gain independence. The records of the treasury list would show fluctuations in how many were paying tribute, this giving some indication of potential rebellions taking place. The ostracism of Thucydides marked somewhat of a low point, though the number of tribute-paying members would increase in the years following, this perhaps showing while Athens was distracted at home, there were those who decided to forego their payments. Though with Pericles and his faction relatively unchallenged after Thucydides' departure, more attention could now be focused on maintaining the empire. This would be the trend until that is the year of 441 or 440, where Athens' attention would once again be focused on dealing with conflict. What would develop in this year was a war that would break out between the island of Samos and the coastal city of Miletus. This was a situation that Athens would need to become involved in, as both were members within their empire. What's more, these two warring states were on the opposite ends of the power scale. Samos was one of the members that still regained some autonomy, as it did not provide tribute, but instead it supplied a powerful fleet to the League. Samos had not been in a position that saw Athens' intervention needed, so they had been left to run their politics as they saw fit, and were not the recipients of garrison colonies. Although they were a League member, they did not hold the same system of government as Athens. They had opted for an oligarchy. On the other side of the conflict, Miletus had had its power as an independent state severely reduced. We had seen that in the 450s, the city had attempted to revolt and would try its luck again a few years later. This had seen Athens take action, which resulted in Miletus handing over its navy and opening itself to Athens, setting up a democratic government within. Miletus, from this point on, would be forced into providing tribute to the League, while also having Athens' oversight. What all of this had done was put Miletus in a vulnerable position. They no longer held the ability to effectively defend themselves. If Athens was going to reduce the city's capacity for self-defense, they would need to ensure that they would respond to the threat. Otherwise, this would send a message of no confidence to all the other members. Also, added to this was the fact that they were both allies of Athens. Athens had to intervene. Others were looking on and seeing how they would react. Thucydides would tell us, we are now referring again to the historian, that conflict between the two had broken out due to a disagreement over the town of Perene. This was located at the base of Mount Mycale, not far from where the Greeks had landed to fight the Persians at the Battle of Mycale in 479. Miletus had been getting the worst of the fighting due to their power imbalance we spoke of. This would then see them seeking Athenian help in the matter, with their messengers also being accompanied by some citizens of Samos, who were in favour of the oligarchic government being overthrown. Having been formally requested for aid in the conflict, Athens would now attempt to resolve the matter through diplomacy, or perhaps their authority, more accurately. A delegation would be sent to Samos, where they were told to cease hostilities and put the quarrel to arbitration to be dealt with. This the Samians rejected and continued their war with Miletus. This now left Athens in a position where they could not just stand by, with a Samian rejection practically an act of defiance. A fleet of 40 ships would be arranged and set sail against Samos, where once arriving, it appears they were able to impose their will relatively easily, as there are no accounts of battles taking place. Once on Samos, the Athenians would replace the oligarchic government with a democracy. An indemnity was imposed on the island of 8 talents, and to ensure that they behaved in a manner to Athens' liking, 50 men and 50 boys were taken hostage and kept on the island of Lemnos, while a garrison was left behind when the fleet departed. Other than that, Samos seemed to have gotten off pretty lightly compared to others. They retained their political independence, and their fleet remained intact. It would seem, given the ease Athens was able to deal with the matter, Samos may have been surprised by the Athenians' reaction and measures imposed, though this would not be the end of the matter, and Samos was now seeing red. While Athens was implementing the changes on Samos, a number of Samians with interests in the oligarchic government fled into Anatolia, though they would keep communications open with the oligarchic leaders in Samos. The hostages that the Athenians took from Samos would have almost certainly been relatives of the previous oligarchic leaders. They themselves could not act openly against Athens just yet for risk of their bloodlines. Those who crossed over into Anatolia would then make their way to the administrative centre of Sardis. Here they would seek the help of Pisithenes, the governor of the region. Supposedly, the Peace of Callias that had been agreed to by Athens and Persia was meant to prevent each other acting in a hostile manner to one another, though the opportunity to cause Athens dramas on the edge of their territory was probably too attractive to pass up. A force of 700 mercenaries was assembled and would head to the coast with the Samians. It seems likely that coordination with the oligarchic leaders on the island was taking place, given the operation the rebels and mercenaries embarked on. They would pass over onto Samos during the night, one would think meeting up with their allies. Then they would target the newly established democratic system by targeting the leaders and imprisoning them, while also capturing the Athenian garrison. Once this had been done, a fleet was sent north to the island of Lemnos, where a successful rescue operation took place, seeing the hostages taken by the Athenians now back in Samos. The oligarchic leaders had now regained control back over Samos, and their relatives now rescued, they are in a position to enter into open revolt against Athens, declaring the island independent. Samos would then turn to continuing their war with Miletus, making arrangements to attack the city. This open defection by Samos would also see Byzantium break out in revolt, with it also seeming areas in Caria, Thrace, the Chalcidides, and the island of Lesbos looking to join the rebellion. Athens' intervention in the war between Samos and Miletus seemed to have stirred up a hornet's nest.
If you have been enjoying the series and thinking of supporting the show, why not head over to the Castings for Ancient Greece Patreon page? Over there, you can extend monthly support to the show, where to show my appreciation, I provide members with early access ad-free episodes, bonus episodes, and video series updates, where we run competitions for members. There are also options available that allow members access to fully referenced show scripts, as well as a personal forum where questions are answered monthly via video. By far and away, the most popular supporter tier is the Strategos level, where access to the bonus episodes opens up. In these bonus episodes, we head back to the beginning of the series and explore certain aspects in more detail. Members can also influence what they would like to see covered in these episodes. Currently, we have just finished exploring the Spartan figure of Lycurgus and the Athenian Solon. We will now be turning our attention to some of the early institutions that would define both Sparta and Athens, with us first turning to the Spartan education system of the Agoge. So, if this sounds like something you would be interested in gaining access to, please consider heading to Patreon and supporting the series there. Alternatively, you can visit the Casting Through Ancient Greece website, where you can find other ways to support the show by clicking on the Support the Series button. Thanks everyone for listening to the series, and I hope you're enjoying the journey.
As we have seen with past revolts, Athens would not let them continue, and this would be no exception. If anything, this was perhaps the most dangerous situation they found themselves in, and the stability of the empire was at real risk. We will look closer at this idea after having gone through Athens' response. Pericles would lead a fleet of 60 ships. However, not all were sent to Samos. This is what gives us the idea that Samos's revolt saw even greater dangers developing. Thucydides tells us that of the 60 ships sent, 16 would be diverted to other areas. Some were sent to watch in the region of Caria for any Phoenician fleet movements. Pericles, by this stage, would have probably been aware of Persian connections to the mercenaries supporting the Samian night attack. Plus, Samos was right on the edge of the Athenian-controlled territories. To put complete faith in the agreement signed with Persia would have been reckless. This lookout would have been able to provide early warning to Pericles' main fleet and also gauge Persian intent. Another small contingent of ships were sent to the islands of Chios and Lesbos, with the aim of seeing they would not revolt, as there were rumours that Lesbos may have been thinking of taking this action. In addition to this, if it could be prevented, a further aim of having both provide reinforcements to the main fleet was also sought. In the meantime, Pericles made for Samos, where it appears the Samians had continued their war with Miletus. It is unclear if the Samians had received word of Athens heading towards Samos and left Miletus to deal with a threat, or had they just been returning by chance from an attack on their enemy. But what would result was a meeting between the two fleets near the small island of Tragia, just south of Samos. The Samian fleet consisted of 70 triremes and 20 transports, while the Athenian fleet was outnumbered, only having 44 triremes. A naval engagement would be fought between the two fleets, and although Athens lacking in numbers, they would be victorious in the battle. This would now leave the waters around Samos undefended, and the shores open for Athens to land on the island. It is around this time that we also hear of reinforcements arriving for the Athenian fleet. This would be in the form of 40 ships sent from Athens, with another 25 from Chios and Lesbos. Originally, it was thought that both Chios and Lesbos were at risk of joining the larger revolt. However, it seems the earlier action of sending ships to negotiate with these two islands had paid off. Not only had both not turned to revolting against Athens, but instead they provided ships to assist with the fight against the rebellion elsewhere. The Athenians would land their forces on the island of Samos, now that its navy had been defeated. Though the Samians were not yet ready to give up, and it appears a battle may have taken place when first setting foot on the island. This was presumably an Athenian victory, as we would hear through Thucydides that Athens would establish their superiority with their ground forces. Once this had taken place, the army then set about setting a siege to the city The island was already blockaded from the sea, as the Athenian navy commanded the waters around. Now, though, the army saw to it that the main city was now cut off from any supply from other areas of the island, with three walls being built to stop supplies getting to the besieged population. With the siege now established and in place, Pericles had to now respond to further threats. It appears Samos was able to get a message back to the Persians to send aid. Pericles left the island with 60 triremes, sailing for Caria, as news had made it to him that a Phoenician fleet was potentially readying to sail against him. It is at this point that the Samians were able to capitalize on this absence of the Athenian commander and a good proportion of manpower. With a good number of ships being sent away from the island, it appears it was now much harder to maintain the blockade and security at sea. The Samians were able to arrange a surprise attack using what ships they had left. They would set their sights on the Athenian camp and fell upon it. It seems Athens had underestimated their enemy at this stage, as they had not bothered to fortify their camp. The Samians were able to destroy the ships that had been posted as lookouts, and were then able to defeat the other ships in battle as they were launched to meet the incoming threat. This essentially broke the blockade, and the Samians regained freedom of movement, and for the next 2 weeks were able to supply the island and city. Though, this freedom would be short-lived, as Pericles, presumably successful in his mission, returned with his fleet. His fleet was strong enough to be able to regain control of the waters around Samos and re-establish the blockade. It would seem even though that Pericles was able to regain control, he recognised his position was not as strong as it had been. He would send word back to Athens and league members, where his request for reinforcements was answered. Athens would see to it that another 60 ships would be sent to Samos, while another 30 would come from Chios and Lesbos. With their previous success, the Samians continued to try and resist the Athenians, but with the Athenian strength increasing through these reinforcements, they were no longer able to uphold their defence. So, after 9 months of siege, Samos finally surrendered. The terms imposed on the island saw them having to pull down their walls, hand over what was left of their fleet, and pay reparations. In addition, hostages would be taken from influential Samian families to ensure that the island would be more inclined to follow Athens' wishes. So, it wasn't that long ago that we were talking about the events surrounding the peace made between Athens and Persia, known as the Peace of Callias. Though, this episode we have seen that Persia was interfering in Athenian affairs around the revolt of Samos. What they had been doing appears to have been in violation of what was agreed to during past negotiations. But again, we are not absolutely certain of how accurate the reported terms were, plus we only have Athens' point of view on this matter. We have nothing from the Persian Empire. However, let us for now assume that the terms are mostly accurate and see if we can try and understand Persia's involvement during these events. I think first of all, we need to understand the time period that these treaties and diplomacies were unfolding in. The Persian Empire was at this stage the largest empire that had existed so far in the ancient world. If a treaty had been arranged, it would have been with Artaxerxes or those representing his authority. This power centre was further east in the interior of the empire, quite far from the western boundary of the empire. Though as we have seen, the Persian Empire was broken up into satraps that would assist in governing the whole empire. These satraps had authority to act on their own for interests within their own region and for the empire as a whole. They would have not been required to send for permission for all actions they took, as this would have been very inefficient, with it taking weeks or months for messengers to be responded to. Remember, messages had to be physically carried for hundreds or thousands of kilometres. This would have seen Sardis, the city governing Anatolia, with the ability to respond to events as they unfolded. The governor would have been aware of what treaties were in place that affected his region, and would have avoided doing anything to blatantly violate it, such as attacking Athens directly or invading one of its league members. This sort of action would need authority from Artaxerxes. However, attempting to take advantage of events surrounding Sardis at Athens' expense would be actions the governor would have been on the lookout for and able to act on. Getting involved in these sorts of localized actions were far more limited and would be done in indirect means, so as not to attack Athens directly. We had seen that in the initial stages after Athens overthrew the ruling oligarchic government of Samos, they fled into Anatolia and into Persian territory. They sought Persian assistance in kicking out Athens of their island and regaining control. For the satrap in Sardis, this would have been attractive, as if successful, it would eliminate Athenian influence in that area and leave it open to Persian influence. The assistance that would be provided was in the form of money that would allow the Samians to recruit their mercenary force. The satrap was careful not to provide his own troops, as this would have been seen as a direct attack from Persia. With the assistance he provided, this would still remain a purely Samian enterprise. As we saw, this defeated the initial Athenian garrison set up on the island. However, after Athens committed more ships and a siege developed, it appears the governor in Sardis was not prepared to cross that line further. Thucydides' account shows how Pericles responded to the threat of the Phoenician ships in the region. However, that's all it may have been, a threat. Or perhaps a fleet readying to sail to Samos had the Samians managed to win back their island. For we hear nothing about Pericles meeting or fighting any fleet backed by Persia. He just returns 2 weeks later to restore Athenian order on Samos. So, even though a peace had existed, Athens and Persia were still opponents of one another. Their interests overlapped in some of the same regions. They would be looking for ways to weaken each other in these regions indirectly, so that the other would have an advantage. This would be done through indirect means, like in the case with Samos, to avoid coming across as breaking the treaty and being seen as the aggressor. It would be done in a way where if the other side reacted directly to their action, they instead would be seen as the aggressor and breaking the agreement. Ultimately, this was a fine line to walk in diplomacy with two sides, but has been common throughout all of history. Next, let's have a quick look at Sparta and their involvement during this episode, as they also had a treaty with the Athenians and may have been looking to take advantage of Athens' situation. Now, through Thucydides' account of the Samian War, we don't hear of any Spartan intervention, though we do learn that it appears Sparta was looking to take action in an attempt to cause Athens issues. This we learn during speeches when Corinth, in 433, would send envoys to Athens convincing them not to accept an alliance the island of Corcyra was offering. It appears during the activities of the Samian Revolt, it was not only Persian officials that Samians visited. They also met with Sparta in an attempt to gain aid against Athens. It then appears this request was taken to the Peloponnesian League so a decision could be made. Sparta did not have to get all the members' votes on this matter, but there was one ally of theirs that they needed the support of, if they were to get involved. Samos was across the other side of the Aegean, and Corinth would be the polis that would supply the vast majority of ships. From the speeches in Thucydides' account, it appears Sparta was in favour of assisting Samos. Even though they also had a treaty with Athens, they too were looking for moments of opportunity to strike at Athens while in a vulnerable situation. We would hear that discussions took place within the Peloponnesian League membership, and opinions would be divided. However, it was Corinth who spoke up against any sort of action. Remember here, Sparta probably didn't really need the backing of other members, it was just Corinth who was key. They would tell the Athenians what unfolded at this conference on the Peloponnese during their later talks with Athens over Corcyra. Did we, on the defection of the Samians, record our vote against you, when the rest of the Peloponnesian powers were equally divided on the question whether they should assist them? No, we told them, to their face, that every power has a right to punish its own allies. This decision by Corinth would see to it that any sort of campaign in assisting Samos would not eventuate. The crucial naval aspect needed would be lacking without their support. So, on the face of it, it looks as though Samos was another failed attempt at a Delian League member trying to regain its independence. However, with the dynamics of what had occurred with Persia and Sparta previously, it would seem this rebellion had the potential to explode into a larger conflict. We had previously spoken about how treaties existed that were supposed to prevent further conflict, with smaller, more limited actions being more likely, instead of direct attacks. But here, I want to bring up a point that Donald Kagan makes in his book, The Outbreak of the Peloponnesian War. This would be around the idea that if an attractive opportunity presented itself that would ultimately see one side crippled or destroyed, then the others would be more willing to risk breaking treaties and seeing war develop. He argues that Persia, although having already taken limited actions with providing funds to the rebels, may have been waiting to see Sparta's actions, with an intention of potentially acting more decisively. If Sparta were to get involved in matters, the intervention in Samos would have most likely seen hostilities on the mainland of Greece break out once again. For Persia, this would have been an attractive prospect, since it would divert attention and forces away from the eastern Aegean. Persia would not need to act right away, as this action would most likely see more eastern Greek cities revolt from Athenian control. We had seen in this episode how Athens had been taking measures to prevent this action as the Samian War was developing. With Athens engaged with another powerful opponent, the League members in the east would have been more willing to risk breaking away. This would then see these islands and cities become more vulnerable from a security standpoint and economically. While Athens was engaged with Sparta, Persia would be able to step in and directly exploit these eastern Greek cities' situation. This then possibly seeing Persian influence once again stretching all along the Anatolian coast. However, Sparta, through Corinth's unwillingness to cooperate in a campaign to Samos, would not end up becoming involved in the Samian Revolt. This would see Persia not wanting to risk become directly involved in Athenian affairs, while they were still in a position to act with the best part of their navy. The Persian fleet had in most cases come off second best when Athens was in a position of strength. With the island of Samos now back under control, Byzantium had also revolted, was falling back into line. The terms that were inflicted on both these places were not as harsh as what had been seen in previous revolts in the Aegean. They don't appear to have been occupied by Athenian garrisons once the revolts ended, while no Athenian official oversaw their government. Both of these places were quite important to Athens' empire in terms of trade access, as well as being good sources of money and ships. Perhaps too harsh a treatment would just see further discontent guaranteed. Pericles didn't want to give Byzantium and Samos any more reason to revolt. After all, the rebellion on Samos didn't occur because of their conditions in the Athenian Empire, but because Athens intervened in a war, helping their enemy. In the wider context of diplomacy, the Samian Revolt had been the first real test of the terms laid down during the 30 Years' Peace. It had tested the notion and agreement that Greece had divided into two spheres of influence, Athens and its empire, and Sparta and its Peloponnesian League. They were supposedly not to interfere in each other's affairs when it came to their allies. Samos had sent messages to the Peloponnesians to try and get assistance, and we saw that it appears the Congress of the Peloponnesian League took place over the matter. We only have the account Corinth gives to Athens to go off on what took place in this meeting. We hear that opinion was divided, but it's not entirely clear on Sparta's true position. However, one would think they would not be holding a meeting on the matter if they had no intention of intervening. Though, the Congress on the Peloponnese would be successful in upholding the intentions of the agreed spheres of influence in the Greek world. The Peloponnesians would not get involved in Athenian matters. So far, it would seem the agreements of the 30 Years' Peace were working to keep conflict at bay between the two established power centres within Greek lands. Though, would it be able to stand for the 30 years it was intended to be in place for? So, in our narrative, we have now arrived at 439 BC. It would be less than 10 years before the Peloponnesian War would engulf all of Greece. Most of the events that we will be covering now will be leading to the breakdown of relations between Sparta and Athens, through Sparta's allies, Corinth being a major one. We have seen Corinth enter into our narrative from an important diplomatic standpoint, and going forward, they will become more influential in matters, leading to the breakout for war. So it is for this reason I want to now just pause where we are in the narrative to look a little closer at the polis of Corinth and their development in history. We will give them much the same treatment we have given other city-states and regions through the series as they have become more prevalent. I'm unsure if this will turn out to be multiple episodes, but we will see what develops as I begin drafting.
Thank you for your continued support and for choosing to support the series through Patreon. Your support means a lot to me and it's very encouraging that you've found some value in the show. I'd like to give a personal shout out to James Kerr, who recently decided to sign up and support the series here on Patreon. I hope you all enjoy the latest bonus episode on Athens' system of tribes, and we will be sticking with Athens for our next bonus episode in March. Once again, everyone, thanks for the support and I hope you look forward to the next series episode, episode 65, The Early History of Corinth. Thank you everyone for your continued support, and a big shout out to all those who have found some value in the series and are being supported on Patreon and other various ways. Your contribution has truly helped me grow the series. I'd like to give a personal shout out to James Kerr for deciding to sign up and support the series over on Patreon recently. I greatly appreciate the support. If you have also found some value in the show and wish to support the series, you can head to www.castingthroughancientgreece.com and click on the Support the Series button, where you can discover many ways to extend your support to helping the series grow. Be sure to stay connected and updated on what's happening in the series, and join me over on Facebook or Instagram at Casting Through Ancient Greece, or on Twitter at Casting Greece. And be sure to subscribe to the series over at the Casting Through Ancient Greece website. I hope you can join me next time when we continue the narrative in the series with episode 65, the early history of Corinth.